Can Republicans and Democrats work together to stabilize the nation's health insurance markets? That question, hopefully, we'll answer in just a moment. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can also stream us live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, after the failure of repeal and replace, what's the path forward for healthcare reform? One local executive gives his take. What do you think? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's Washington Post reporter Dan Zak as we speak to him about his new book, Almighty, a look at nuclear power. Plus, fighting the spread of HIV and AIDS in Duval County. We'll tell you how local groups are working to educate young people here on the First Coast about getting tested. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress are coming together this week to try to prevent a collapse of the health insurance market. The Senate Health Committee says it will hold bipartisan hearings next month on how to repair the individual market. Meanwhile, in the House, a group of about 40 lawmakers from both parties has endorsed an outline of ideas aimed at making some urgent fixes to Obamacare. Now, this is a sharp departure from President Trump. He has taken a hard line on the Affordable Care Act after legislative efforts failed last week in the Senate to repeal and replace it. Trump says he wants to let Obamacare implode. In a series of tweets this weekend, the president threatened to stop paying insurance companies cost-sharing subsidies that help lower those out-of-pocket expenses for low-income policyholders. The president called them bailouts. So, what is the way forward for healthcare exactly, and what can be done to stabilize insurance markets, a concern for millions? This morning, a closer look. We welcome Chris Fay. He's a Jacksonville healthcare executive with more than three decades in managed care and insurance plans. Fay is the founder and CEO of Big Bang Health. That's a network of healthcare providers serving the self-funded employer market. He joins us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on, and thanks to WJCT for allowing me to be here today.
Sure thing. And here's our question to callers. How important do you think it is that Republicans and Democrats in Washington try to work together to stabilize the health insurance markets and put together a new way forward for health insurance coverage in this country? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page. And, you know, Congress has to come up with a solution before the end of September. Chris, that's when insurers will sign contracts with the federal government over what insurance plans to sell on the healthcare exchange, which is still live next year. About 18 million Americans get their insurance in the individual market, and they're watching this closely. But then going beyond that, all of us who have health insurance are concerned about if we're going to see a huge spike in premiums, if our insurance is suddenly going to become unavailable, lots of worry and anxiety out there. Let me ask you first off, do you think the two parties can come together and at least stabilize the markets right now?
Well, thank you again for having me on today. And I think before I answer that question specifically, let me make just a statement around everybody talks about healthcare. There's lots of discussion that's in the news everywhere. Everywhere people are talking about it. You have to understand that health insurance is risk stratification. This is part of what's actually the problem with Obamacare. It costs about $4 trillion, they're predicting, the next year or two on a, you know, per year in the United States. Somebody has to pay that. It doesn't matter. You say, oh, the government's going to pay it. Well, that's coming from who? The taxpayer. You say, well, the employer's going to pay it. Well, that's coming, you know, it's indirectly coming from the employee. So it's a very complicated issue, and it's easy to soundbite that, oh, let's stabilize healthcare. I just heard on your station before we broadcast this morning a discussion of the uncertainty in the market from the, quote, national health plans who are looking at the individual market, and it's hard to predict what to charge as a premium. and that depends on the risk stratification, the mix of the people who sign up. If you end up with only people who have chronic conditions, which are much more expensive, and you set your premium thinking you were going to have a blend, you know, across the whole, you know, age categories, you're going to be wrong. And in fact, that's one reason why the subsidies are there, taxpayer dollars. I think that number is about $20 billion or something like that. Our money, nobody asked us for it to, you know, authorize that check. But that is in essence to subsidize this mix, unbalanced mix. And then the other way they do it is they increase the premiums, which I just saw this morning that predicting double digits increases. This is following double digit increases last year.
Hey, but let me just jump in. That's not acceptable to anyone, whether you like the Affordable Care Act or not. And so given that it remains the law of the land, at least for the time being, as a healthcare executive, and your company is Big Bang Health, by the way. Oh, and by the way, I've also been told you're a cousin of Tina Fey.
My claim.
Have you given her any ideas about healthcare skits she might do?
Yes, I think that's probably something in the works.
Okay.
This is a very. Weren't so serious, it would be funny.
It'd be funny, yes. Right? But lives are at stake. Well, so you own a healthcare company. You know, obviously, it's not easy to reduce this down to a soundbite. Don't you think that at the minimum, Congress has an obligation to stabilize the market so that those who are insured remain that way?
I agree. Most Americans get their health insurance through some type of employer-sponsored piece of it. Obamacare was primarily focused on the uninsured, the individual market, which is a lot more, quote, riskier. I like to tell people that the sound bites that we're hearing out of Washington is kind of like trying to rearrange the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. If you don't attack the problem, meaning, you know, how do we as consumers shop better for healthcare? You know, here in Jacksonville, you go from one side of town to the other. There's a big variation in the price of a CT scan. You probably don't know how to shop for a CT scan, but in fact, this is happening, you know, day in and day out. My point is that I wouldn't worry so much about what they're doing in Washington. What the individual can do, though, is to really understand how healthcare works, understand their benefit plans, because what's happening today, this deductible is now on your responsibility, which is now in the thousands, meaning you're basically paying for your own healthcare. So you better be a better shopper. If I were giving the people in Washington some advice, I would go after some really low-hanging fruit to cut the cost, because it's the cost divided by.
And what's the lowest hanging fruit?
Well, in my opinion, and this is something I think that would come somewhat of a shock to your listeners, and that is, as we have outlined in a white paper that we published, shockingly, 20% of all diagnoses are incorrect. That's 1 out of 5. If the mail came, you know, to you and was missing 1 out of 5 pieces, you'd probably be unhappy. The misdiagnosis rate, this was a study that came out from the Mayo Clinic, and it's been tracked over years.
So you get unnecessary tests, perhaps, a lot more costs built into the system that way?
Yeah, and a way to look at that, again, I would just advise anyone to always think about making sure that if you get diagnosed, that you get another opinion, that you actually get a confirmatory.
That second opinion is real.
It is. Well,
yeah.
Again, particularly
you need to do
with this miss rate of the 20%, meaning 1 in 5. If you could fix that, that estimate is about $700 billion a year.
What are some other ways to save money?
Well, that's one key one is to get the right diagnosis, which you just said. If you have the wrong diagnosis, you're going down that trail spending your money because it's coming out of your pocket first and then coming out of the employer's pocket or coming out of the government's pocket, but it leads to more costs. And that number is $700 billion estimate. The second thing, which is shocking, and this is how healthcare works, which is, should be important for everybody here to understand, and that is that if you're part of the 80% who were diagnosed correctly, remember 20% are incorrect, if you're part of the 80%, the odds of you actually getting, quote, the instruction booklet on how to manage that chronic condition that you've been diagnosed for is 50-50. It's a 50% here's the instructions to help you take care of your particular
condition. So wait a minute. Are you saying we don't have the best healthcare system in the world?
Well, it's certainly...
Which is what we're constantly told.
Well, and ranking, I think, in quality of health, which has been done by the World Health Organization and others, we're actually about 37th.
Yeah, our outcomes are not great for what we're spending, which is so outrageous and upsetting to people across the political spectrum.
And I just gave you two reasons for that.
Two reasons why. And of course, there are others. But let me ask you now, you said don't worry too much about what's going on in Washington. Figure out your own situation. That said, do you think that this new caucus in the House of Representatives, the Problem Solvers Caucus, they're called, 40 Republicans and Democrats, they want to put forth some ideas aimed at making urgent fixes to the current system. What do you think of these? Mandatory funding for cost-sharing reduction payments, the creation of a stability fund, a repeal of the medical device tax, raise the threshold of the employer mandate so that companies with 500 employees or more have to provide health insurance. Currently, the employer mandate is 50 or more. So it would put the burden on much bigger companies. What do you think of those ideas?
Well, I think a couple of them are tax dollars, where they've said, let's have the stabilization fund. What is that? That's to support the, quote, imbalance in the risk, being money, taxpayer money, going to an insurance company. The money has to come from somebody. That's basically what I said originally. Second piece, well, again, those first two things that you mentioned are really to taxpayer, we're going to pay for it and redistribute the wealth, if you will. The other things that I believe will be effective, again, the two things I just mentioned, if we could enhance the misdiagnosis, enhance the care coordination. And there's a third piece of this, which ties right into the opiate war,
epidemic.
Epidemic that we're hearing about too, is that substance abuse is widespread across the United States. Low-hanging fruit. The people who are, quote, substance abuse users, meaning whether they're taking drugs or alcohol, et cetera, have three times the hospitalization rate of somebody who isn't. These are costs that are in the system that nobody up in D.C. talks about where some of these opportunities are. Having met Harry Reid, and after Obamacare was passed, I was right there in Washington talking with many of the leaders that passed the bill that nobody had a chance to read, and now it's coming back to, quote, haunt everybody.
The Republicans did the same thing.
Correct.
In effect, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very hard to say, oh, we're going to fix 20% of the U.S. economy. That's what healthcare is, just shy of 20% of the entire economy. You can't just say, let's pass a bill and let's fix that. Adding coverage to people who need it is terrific if you look at what it's actually costing them. And if you, again, look at deductibles, there's no free lunch. And I think what I understand that is going to be more discussion, more confusing, more politicking, more et cetera, and what may very well happen is a couple of tiny fixes. Let's see, and let it sit and see what happens, while we, the individual or the individuals, your listeners or others, get left in the lurch.
Not too encouraging.
No.
But let's get some calls for you, Chris, and see what people out there think about this. Repeal and replace went down to defeat in the Senate. Now a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress say they're going to try to work together to stabilize insurance markets and tweak the current system. What do you think about that? 549-2937 as we speak with Chris Fay of Big Bang Health. Fred is in St. Augustine. Hey, Fred, good morning. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hey, go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, there's a real easy cure to this situation that apparently it's so easy everyone overlooked it. If you want to resolve the healthcare situation, we need a national amendment passed to the Constitution where Congress has to abide by the laws that they pass. Therefore, if Congress was required to have Obamacare instead of getting a $10,000 80% subsidy at our expense, it might resolve that issue and many others.
Fred, thanks for the call. That's been a rallying cry among conservatives that Congress should have to buy the same health care as everybody else. Most members of Congress and a number of other federal employees get their health care through a DC exchange that was created specifically for people on Capitol Hill. And he mentioned the subsidy. It's my understanding from the NPR program Marketplace that the subsidy is actually a little less than the subsidies Obamacare provides to lower-income Americans. But what do you think about his comment?
Well, I think it's interesting, and it's not just in healthcare, but many other rules that are passed by Congress they don't have to abide by. And that's unfortunate. I think the gentleman has a great idea. Yeah, if you're going to force us to utilize this benefit, then you better be right there with us and get a taste of how it works yourself. So I would agree with him. That's one of many things that to be done.
Okay. Rick is in Riverside. Hello, Rick. Good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to express my support for single-payer health care for a couple of reasons. One is I'm not sure with a wholly for-profit system, the providers and the insurance companies together, that you're ever going to get the kind of premiums that most people need. I want to point out that the average overhead cost for a private insurance company is between 15% and 20%, whereas that of Medicare, last I checked, was about 3% to 4%. That cost savings in a single-payer system can be used to reduce premiums. The other problem is that as long as it's a for-profit system, the providers get paid for what they do, not for what they don't do, not for what they prevent. And that prevention portion is a significant portion, a part of cost savings as well. There, I would recommend something like the Cuban model, where relatively simple procedures are provided in the community by trained practitioners, but that takes the weight off of hospitals, emergency rooms, and other more expensive parts. The only other thing that I would point out is that the problem is not in the system, but in the ability of the well-financed companies to defeat any kind of public option, any kind of reasonable process for delivering health care. The last thing I wanted to say is that we need to look at health care not as a right provided in the Constitution and not as an ordinary product, but as something like utility service or fire departments that must be socialized in order to be effective. Once upon a time, all those things were privatized, and they no longer are because, like healthcare, they became so important to an ordinary level of living that they had to be socialized.
All right, Rick. Thanks for the call. Thank you, Rick. Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders is planning to introduce legislation calling for a public option. A government-funded insurance plan, or as some have called it, expanding Medicare to more people to compete with the private market. What about Rick's comment?
Well, I think he made very good comments. Thank you, Rick. I appreciate your statement there. One thing for people to think about is that if you take a look at the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, essentially, that is government-sponsored single-payer. It's Medicare and Medicaid. It's about half of the total spend is already in a, quote, single-payer. And so, yeah, if you say we'll expand it.
And there's TRICARE for veterans.
And TRICARE for veterans.
Yeah, millions of Americans are on a single-payer type plan. What about the idea of extending it to more people?
With one other thing I was going to mention, that if you'd look at the way the government works, in fact, many of your listeners may be on a Medicare Advantage plan, which is an HMO, managed care plan for Medicare. Medicare doesn't actually provide managed care. They subcontract that out to private enterprise, like companies that have Medicare Advantage plans, Humana, Florida Blue, and Aetna, and others. So, you know, it's not like this is a shock that anybody would talk about it when, in fact, half of the country is already in some form of single payer as it is today. More competition across all industries has shown to actually drive better pricing. One thing I do want to, again, make the point, the individual ultimately is in control of their health. You think, well, my doctor is sitting up at night, can't wait to see me, and he's been studying all my, that's just not happening. There's too much activity that goes through a provider's day-to-day resources. The more you, the more Rick, the more the people that know about how do I navigate the system, the better off that they will be. It's unfortunate that in Washington they don't talk about that important role. I was written up in an article in Self Insurer magazine just a few weeks ago talking about the role of care advocacy. When I get my chance to talk in D.C. about this subject, my opinion is you could fix a whole lot of the cost issues here if people were assigned really their own care manager. That would be somewhat like if you went to build a house. Maybe you don't know how to build a house. You might hire a contractor that knows how to build houses and how to get the best prices and all the different components. I think the role that is missing in the government proposals and even missing in many health plans across the country is this care advocate. We call it mission control in our business. We think everybody that's in our, quote, health plan deserves to have a mission control specialist to help them figure out what a CT scan costs. And also to make sure that you have the proper diagnosis. One thing, again, back to this misdiagnosis, pathology slides have an even higher rate of misdiagnosis. You wouldn't know that. Again, I think this care management piece that is important for the people who have conditions could be the most important thing that they do in Washington. And single payer sounds great. It would ultimately be outsourced but to commercial companies to provide the service, and it really gets right back to who pays that bill. It costs $4 trillion a year to pay for everything. You can divide it up however you want, some to the employer, some to the individual, some to government, some to Medicaid, some to the state. It's never reduced in cost since they've been tracking healthcare costs. It's never gone down. It's always gone up, and look forward to more of that.
Terry on the South Side. Go ahead, Terry.
Hi. Yeah, so we're actually paying a mortgage payment a month for our insurance. And then my child had an accident, and it turns out we weren't covered by the children's hospital. So every time we went in, we were just like, we felt horrible for our child and the fact that we didn't know if we were going to go bankrupt over this accident. And then the hospital said, oh, you don't have insurance, you get a 75% discount. So isn't it better to eliminate the insurance companies if it's so much cheaper for just a single pay than to go with the insurance company?
Okay. And of course, you're an insurer. So what would you say? And by the way, I won't read all the emails out loud, but we're getting lots of emails saying, in effect, the insurance companies are the problem here. What would you say to those who really, they don't like your business? They think it's part of the problem, not the solution.
Well, I would tell you that, number one, there's a lot of great companies here in Jacksonville and elsewhere that are terrific insurance companies. And I would say don't blame, quote, the insurance companies as much as you need to understand the system. The $4 trillion healthcare system is extremely complex. I think President Trump has figured that out. This is not an easy fix kind of a thing. In the scenario that you just mentioned, which gets back to, quote, consumer literacy about how to purchase healthcare services, this young lady just made a statement. She said, well, they were going to gut us a deal if we paid directly. And one of the funny things about how healthcare works, when they say you have a 75% discount, is it 75% of charges? Charges are like the highest rate you could pay for anything. So sometimes when you get a discount from a provider that says pay direct, you may be still paying more than the insurance company would reimburse them for. She's an informed consumer, and that's terrific. And I, again, would suggest that everybody understand more about how to buy healthcare, get the right diagnosis, get the right care pathways, and more competition will certainly will help slow pricing. It's never going to go down. It's never going to cost less. It's Never has, and I don't think it ever will.
Chris Fay of Big Bang Health, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And much more still ahead later. Educating local kids about HIV and AIDS. We'll look ahead to a special event. But up next, with nuclear threats around the world, author Dan Zak about America's love-hate relationship with the bomb. That's coming up. We'll be right back.
When Boingo Wireless was born, tech was a whole different kind of thing.
We believed in the wireless internet would be a economy-changing, world-changing technology. Did we know that there was going to be this thing called the iPhone? Obviously not.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Boingo's CEO on the fast-paced Wi-Fi life. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I just didn't know which was my soulmate animal until I was in sixth grade when I finally discovered that it was Drosophila melanogaster, the common fruit fly.
Join us for more true stories told live. This week, pets, pine trees, adoption, tricycles, and a silent retreat. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, John Scofield presents music from his record Quiet and reunites with his Blue Matter Electric Fusion roots.
When we started to play, I did get chills from the songs and remembering all the good times we had because the music reminds me of some real friends.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Tuesday the U.S. does not seek regime change in North Korea and would actually agree to a dialogue with the secretive nation if it abandons its nuclear weapons program. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has defied the United States and other world powers by pursuing nuclear weapons. North Korea's latest test Friday indicated its missiles are now capable of reaching U.S. cities. At the same time, Iran said Tuesday that it has lodged a complaint with the commission that polices possible violations of the Iranian nuclear agreement. Now, the complaint accuses the U.S. of breaching the 2015 deal between Iran and six world powers, including the United States. At a time of growing concern about nuclear proliferation in places like Iran and North Korea, our own U.S. arsenal is plagued by its own security problems. In the new book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age, now out in paperback, Washington Post reporter Dan Zak examines America's love-hate relationship with the nuclear bomb, from the race to achieve atomic power before the Nazis to the solemn 70th anniversary of Hiroshima. Dan Zak is on the line now with more. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And what are your thoughts about our nuclear arsenal and nuclear power and threats around the world? Give us a call at 549-2937 as we speak with the Post's Dan Zak, author of Almighty. And so this issue is incredibly concerning and current, just given headlines over the last week, Dan. But in your book, you go beyond what's happening right now and look at the roots of atomic power. What drew you to this topic, first of all?
Well, you know, there's a central incident in this book. Three peace activists in 2012 broke into a nuclear weapons facility in East Tennessee, and that was really what caught my attention. I knew nothing about this subject, about nuclear weapons, but I had heard about this break-in, these three senior citizens cutting through four fences in the middle of the night and getting up to the building that stores all of our highly enriched uranium. And that was enough to catch my attention and make me ask, what is this facility they broke into, and who are these people, and why did they do this? And when I started learning why and what this facility did, I kind of went down the rabbit hole of nuclear weapons, and it forced me to kind of look at history to place this incident in context, and the book is the result of that.
Right, and as you write it in Almighty, our greatest modern-day threat is nuclear weapons. It's not something that we think about very often. We seem to be so much more afraid of other things, terrorism, natural disasters. Nuclear power is always lurking there in the background, though, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's receded in the popular imagination because, you know, the Cold War ended, what, 25 years ago now? There hasn't been a mushroom cloud on planet Earth since 1963 when nations started or stopped above-ground nuclear testing. You know, it's not as visible and in-your-face as small terrorist events around the world, or even something as existential, equally existential as climate change, where you can kind of log on or look at the nightly news and see giant chunks of glacier collapsing into the ocean. There's nothing really like that in nuclear weapons where you can say, gosh, this is unfolding right now, and it's terrible and destructive. But the threat of it is kind of omnipresent. It's just less visible, I think.
Right. And it was made visible, as you write, in 2012 when the activists broke into the complex in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. That is concerning, you say, because what if it had been a group of terrorists accessing those nuclear bombs rather than a trio of peace activists? It wasn't as secure as people thought.
Right, exactly. And in the congressional hearings that resulted from this embarrassing break-in, that's exactly what representatives brought up. They said, you know, basically in an open hearing, thank God this was just a 82-year-old Catholic sister who came in and not someone intent on some nefarious action. So it is concerning. It's the building they got up to, you know, is strong enough, fortified enough to withstand the impact of a commercial jet. So this is a very strong, secure facility in some regards, but it's very concerning that three people using only bolt cutters could get as far as they did. And their intent was to expose what they see as the false idol of national security. And unfortunately, they were quite successful in doing that.
In your book, you really are trying to draw attention to the fact that the nuclear powers, U.S. and Russia in particular, possess enough nuclear weaponry to destroy the world several times over. And you question the wisdom of continuing to maintain this massive arsenal. That's challenging the accepted narrative, I think, of the last several decades, that we must have these weapons as a deterrent.
Yeah, I mean, what these activists that I write about believe is that this arsenal should not exist. It's not only illegal to have it, but immoral to maintain it. And, of course, the accepted wisdom, especially in Washington, is that these weapons have staved off a World War III, that they have kept a global peace, that the creation of nuclear weapons has made major power global war so abhorrent that no one would dare start one. I think that there are, solid criticisms to level at that notion, that it prevents conflict or major power war. The only way to kind of confirm that would be to get rid of all of them and see if World War III breaks out. It's just that no one wants to do that, and that includes presidents, that includes people who work in Washington. We have this arsenal, and it is the foundation of our national security strategy. And part of that is also, these are really political weapons, too. They're kind of designed not to be used, and so they become bargaining chips, for example, with Russia. We will only eliminate a certain number if Russia eliminates a certain number, and so we're not about to act all on our own if we can use them as bargaining chips.
Mm-hmm. And do you see the threat of nuclear proliferation coming from smaller actors like Iran or North Korea, or are you more concerned about security lapses with our own arsenal, or both?
I think the concerns are equal in my mind. I mean, unfortunately, the problem is as long as countries like the United States communicate or imply how important these weapons are to our own security, there are going to be other nations who say, well, if you have them, why can't we? If they're so important to you, why can't we have them as well? Unfortunately, they have a cachet. The reason North Korea has a nuclear weapons program and now has missiles that are apparently capable of reaching the United States is because it elevates the status of what is otherwise an impoverished, insular, backward country. Suddenly we have to treat them with a certain amount of deference. So the symbol and the power just in the existence and possession of these weapons is profound in and of itself. So that's certainly a concern, but at the same time, you know, like the incident that I describe in my book, if these kind of lapses happen, you know, how secure are arsenals in, say, Pakistan or India if even the United States doesn't have a full 100% handle on its own kind of atomic power?
And if you're just tuning in right now, we're speaking with Washington Post reporter Dan Zak, author of Almighty, a look at nuclear proliferation. What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Dave, along U.S. 17, is on the line. Hey, Dave, good morning.
Good morning. I'm always concerned when I hear people making the mistake of conflating nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I mean, nuclear weapons, even Colin Powell has said, are effectively useless. They're essentially the means of humanity's self-destruction. But nuclear power, on the other hand, is something that we could be using to alleviate the ravages of climate change by providing us with a carbon-free electricity source. So I really would wish that people would understand that there is a very big difference between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Nuclear power plants can't explode. They aren't bombs, and they can't be bombs. But they are capable of producing carbon-free, pollution-free power. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
And go ahead, Dan. That's an important distinction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important distinction to make because a lot of people do conflate them. And I made my specific mission with my book was to not touch on nuclear power at all, to only focus on the other side of nuclear reaction, which is military and weapons of war. A lot of activists, a lot of anti-nuclear activists are against any kind of nuclear activity, power plants or weapons. But I, for the sake of this book, focused only on the weapons, only on the side of nuclear activity that could result in the deaths of millions of people. And I make the point early on in the book, invoking Niels Bohr, the famous scientist, who talked about the notion of complementarity, that a nuclear reaction could either light a city with power or it could destroy a city. It all depends on how you use it.
Sure. And what are your thoughts just this week about the administration's reaction toward Iran? Iran's saying Tuesday that they are lodging a complaint about violations of the 2015 nuclear deal struck under the Obama administration. It eased or ended sanctions on Iran in return for that country pledging peaceful nuclear work. President Trump has railed against this deal, presumably might be looking for a rationale to scrap that accord. In your view, would that be the right or the wrong way to handle this situation as we look at Iran as a nuclear power?
You know, I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I would say that scotching that deal, getting rid of it, would be a mistake. It's the only thing that's preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon in the next 10 or 15 years. Without this deal, they would need a far shorter time to develop a weapon. So it is. I think it's concerning that the president is basically, there are reports that he said he's looking for any reason to say that Iran is in violation of this deal and to scrap it. Right now, that deal is the only thing that is capping, that is preventing Iran from producing the fissile material that could create a nuclear warhead.
It's fascinating to speak with you. And by the way, this book is out now in paperback, correct? So more widely available.
That's correct.
It's Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age from the Washington Post's Dan Zak. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we'll be right back.
R. Kelly is in trouble. Ticket sales for the R&B legend have dropped, and concerts have been canceled following accusations that he held young women in a sex cult. Some news organizations thought the story was reliable based on court documents and police reports, but was too risky to run. Why? The R. Kelly saga and how the singer is fighting back, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Tracy Long was always healthy until she had a birth control device implanted. Now she's going under the knife to get it out.
Because of these implants, I have to have invasive surgery and lose body organs.
And she's worried, what else could go wrong?
What if I never wake up from this? And really just the fear of the unknown.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, HIV and AIDS is an epidemic here on the First Coast. Duval County has one of the highest rates of infection in the state, and Florida has the second highest number of HIV and AIDS cases in the nation. Now, the Northeast Florida AIDS Network has been working to address this epidemic for years. They're doing something about it this week. On Friday, local agencies, including NFAN, will come together to educate people about HIV and AIDS. It's the first annual Youth Block Party. Spokeswoman Katrina Odell is here now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for being here. And more about the event in a moment, a way to get the message out to hundreds of young people. This is a big issue, though. More than 6,000 people in Jacksonville living with HIV and AIDS. And not only do we have a problem in Duval County, we have a huge problem in Florida. We are second in the nation for new cases behind New York State. So lots of work to be done about testing and awareness, right?
That is very correct, especially in our youth. It's a growing issue, and we need to get the information out to our youth in order to prevent the spread of this virus.
And for years, the Northeast Florida AIDS Network has been working on that, talking about the importance of testing, talking about the importance of condoms. How do you think the message is or is not getting through to younger people?
I believe the message is not getting through to younger people because of stigma. They really don't believe that it's going to affect them. Some youth are scared that their friends may look at them weird, or if they're having to pick up condoms in order to protect themselves, that their friends may, you know, say other messages that makes them
less likely to do so.
Correct.
And there's also, young people are still likely to believe inaccurate information too, aren't they, about how HIV and AIDS is spread?
Yes. They believe it can be spread through saliva or kissing and stuff like that, and that's not the case. So they're very uneducated about how you can get the disease. And here at the Youth Block Party, that's what we're wanting to do. We're going to educate the children on the ways that HIV can be spread, as well as giving them more educational information about how to properly use condoms and how to protect themselves against this disease.
Now, this is coming up Friday, the first annual Youth Block Party for the city at A. Philip Randolph Park. That's at A. Philip Randolph Boulevard, not too far away here from our WJCT studios. You're going to try to reach hundreds of kids aged 16 to 24. What's going to be happening?
Okay, so at the block party, we're going to be having live music. There'll be local artists there, radio stations. There's going to be food, games. We're going to be giving away back-to-school supplies. Again, this is for the children ages 16 to 24. We're going to have a bunch of different community resources geared towards our young adults and youth. There'll be work sources out there ready for work. We'll have substance abuse agencies. There's going to be a lot of youth-centric organizations out there in order to just get as much educational information out to our youth. There'll also be the HIV vans out there testing.
So any teenager or young adult that wants a test can get one?
Yes. They do not need consent. We're, like I say, 16 to 24. They'll just go up to the vans, take the test. It's not a very long process. It only takes a couple minutes, and the youth will get their status right there on the spot and any kind of other education or training that they or counseling that they may need.
Just a couple of weeks left till kids go back to school. So those back to school supplies might be a nice extra incentive for people to come out, right?
That is definitely true. It will also help out the parents and youth to be more set for returning to school. We all need a little bit of help.
What would you say to parents listening who have alarm about this? Maybe they're in a bit of denial about their child's sexual activity and the need for them maybe to get tested.
I would ask parents, as a mother of teenagers, please let your kids go out and attend this function. You know, we don't want to think that our children are out there performing in activities that can get them infected, but we have to get over that denial and allow them to come out and get the education and get the information and, you know, get tested and let them know their status so that way they can know within their self what they're doing. And, you know, we don't have to accept maybe that they're doing it, but let them go out and get the information because our kids aren't always going to tell us what they're doing.
And testing, HIV and AIDS testing, isn't generally available in the school system. So this is a pretty unusual opportunity for teens and young adults to get the free test, isn't it?
Yes, to abstinence is what is basically taught in school. And the reality of it is abstinence is not necessarily what's taking place. So it's very critical that the kids get out here and get this education that they're not able to get in the schools.
Okay, so it's the first annual youth block party this Friday, August 4th, from 2 to 6 p.m., free and open to all youth age 16 to 24, as the Northeast Florida AIDS Network provides food, music, games, and back-to-school supplies, along with that test.
It is the Area for Prevention Agency. So it's not just Northeast Florida AIDS Network. It is all the local prevention agencies from UF Health, Gateway, River Regions, the City of Jacksonville, Duval County Health, Jasmine, CAN, and Black Leadership AIDS Crisis Coalition. We're all coming together in order to make this event happen for our youth in Duval County.
A big community-wide effort. How can people get their youth groups over there? Just it's free to the public. Just
it
come
is,
on out to APR Park.
Yes, that is true. Is it? There'll be everyone who shows up. You'll get there at APR Park. You'll be welcome to come in. Again, that's any youth ages 16 to 24. The parents can drop their kids off and let them have fun so that way they can be honest with what they need to do, or the parents are welcome to join them if they would like to get further information for themselves.
Katrina O'Dell with Northeast Florida AIDS Network, thanks for joining us.
Again, thank you for Melissa for having us. We appreciate that.
Sure. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation and the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your news. Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.